So we'll finish our look at this chapter, the sixth man in the universe in the life divine, this evening. So there is an unknowable which fashions or formulates or knows itself positively as a supreme reality, as Satchit Ananda. This posits itself in the universe diffusely and in the individual concentratedly. And it is the relationship between the individual and the universe which is the progressive revelation of this reality as we move from ignorance to light and complete the intention that's concealed in the heart of the cosmos. We read a chapter we closed with a paragraph last week that I'd like to start with this week. We read it through because of its power of expression, but let's go back and look at it a little more. The universe comes to the individual as life, a dynamism, the entire secret of which he has to master, and the mass of colliding results, a whirl of potential energies out of which he has to disengage some supreme order and some yet unrealized harmony. This is, after all, the real sense of man's progress. It is not merely a restatement in slightly different terms of what physical nature has already accomplished, nor can the ideal of human life be simply the animal repeated on a higher scale of mentality. Otherwise, any system or order which assured a tolerable well-being and a moderate mental satisfaction would have stayed our advance. The animal is satisfied with a modicum of necessity. The gods are content with their splendors, but man cannot rest permanently until he reaches some highest good. He is the greatest of living beings because he is the most discontented, because he feels most the pressure of limitations. He alone, perhaps, is capable of being seized by the divine frenzy for a remote ideal. So again, we see notes sounded in here that have been with us from the opening paragraphs of the Life Divine. He has to disengage some supreme order and realize an unrealized harmony, because all problems of life, Sri Aurobindo has noted, are problems of harmony. So we cannot rest. We are looking for an order behind chaos. We are looking for a bliss behind suffering. No plateau is acceptable for us. However agreeable we might be able to engage life to compromise with matter and have a pretty good round of existence, there is something in us which is unsatisfied yet, which has to push on beyond. As Sri Aurobindo notes it here, it is unique to the human that we are pushed and that we are capable of this divine frenzy. Probably he is referring to the Greek term enthusiasmos here, which means God-inspired zeal. It's the real root of the idea of enthusiasm. Enthusiasm is not excitement. Enthusiasm is something far deeper. It is not vital in orientation. It comes from something soul-based in us. Divine frenzy can also be translated in Latin as divino furore. And this played an important role, this idea, during the Renaissance with the mystical formulations of Ficino. So those of you who are lovers of the mysticism, that was a re-investigation of what had been achieved in Neoplatonism, will find a thread coming all the way from Plato and the Phaedrus through Neoplatonism up through Ficino, and finding its entrance even into our language here. But of course, for Sri Aurobindo, he is not looking for Platonic resonances here, but he's drawing from that field of experience and insight which are familiar to the Upanishads. So we'll continue with the next paragraph then. To the life spirit, therefore, the individual in whom its potentialities center is preeminently man, the Purusha. It is the son of man who is supremely capable of incarnating God. So this is a reference back to the theism of early Christianity, and also a reference to the idea of the Purusha here being a representation of that supreme Purusha, which is Vedic and Upanishadic. And then he continues this lineage. This man is the Manu, the thinker, the Manomaya Purusha, mental person or soul in mind of the ancient sages. No mere superior mammal is he, but a conceptive soul basing itself on the animal body and matter. You may be familiar with an Upanishad which suggests that as creation is being arranged, the gods are looking for a vehicle in which they can manifest. And they're shown the various figures of prominent animals, of the cow, of the horse, etc. And the gods look and say, no. No, no. Finally, when the human form is shown, they say, yes, verily, into this we will manifest. And so there's the idea, isn't it, that the human creature is capable of putting on the robes of divinity, of being manifest God. He is, to continue, conscious name or noumen, accepting and utilizing form as a medium through which person can deal with substance. The animal life, emerging out of matter, is only the inferior term of his existence. The life of thought, feeling, will, conscious impulsion, that which we name in its totality mind, that which strives to seize upon matter and its vital energies and subject them to the law of its own progressive transformation, is the middle term in which he takes his effectual station. So rising out of mere life in the body to a station of mentality is the middle term. We can see it's the middle term because it's transitional. We don't have full knowledge, we don't have full power, we don't have full satisfaction. So none of the beatitudes or the nature of a true existence or the fullness of consciousness, which are native to Satchitananda, have yet been fulfilled in the human. So we must press on. What is that next term? But there is equally a supreme term which mind and man searches after so that having found, he may affirm it in his mental and bodily existence. This practical affirmation of something essentially superior to his present self is the basis of the divine life in the human being. So there's much packed into this. That supreme term still has to grasp and live in mental life. It has to occupy life and mind and body all at once. It can't leave it out. It can't cancel it and say, now that you have found your way from the mind to this greater, this superior term, you can cancel the lower terms of existence out. It must come in and complete it. And it is that new consciousness, which is the supramental, which becomes the basis of life. Right now, we may presume, we may see and feel that we begin in matter, that's our base, and then we learn how to live, and then we learn how to think and reflect about our lives. But when we reach that higher term, it is the supramental consciousness which becomes the basis of our life and fulfills matter and fulfills life and fulfills mind. So now, on to the next paragraph. Awakened to a profounder self-knowledge than his first mental idea of himself, man begins to conceive some formula and to perceive some appearance of the thing that he has to affirm. But it appears to him as if poised between two negations of itself. If, beyond his present attainment, he perceives or is touched by the power, light, bliss of a self-conscious, infinite existence, and translates his thought or his experience of it into terms convenient for his mentality, infinity, omniscience, omnipotence, immortality, freedom, love, beatitude, God. Yet does this sun of his seeing appear to shine between a double night, a darkness below, a mightier darkness beyond. For when he strives to know it utterly, it seems to pass into something which neither any one of these terms nor the sum of them can at all represent. His mind at last negates God for a beyond, or at least it seems to find God transcending himself, denying himself to the conception. Here also, in the world, in himself and around himself, he is met always by the opposites of his affirmation. Death is ever with him. Limitation invests his being and his experience. Error, inconscience, weakness, inertia, grief, pain, evil are constant oppressors of his effort. Here also, he is driven to deny God, or at least the divine seems to negate or to hide itself in some appearance or outcome which is other than its true and eternal reality. This idea of this bright reality, seizable to us as an essence, and even discoverable in forms behind the phenomena of our existence, has a darkness bordering our experience below and a darkness above. That darkness above, of course, is what he has called earlier the unknowable, non-being, that which remains free even from its supreme manifestation as Satchitananda. That is that supreme darkness. Below, of course, is the collapse into the things that deny existence altogether. Death, insentience. And here, we can see that in this idea that beyond God is a beyond, and that God transcends himself in attaining that, we have an echo of Meister Eckhart, you know, a great Christian thinker in the late Middle Ages, who described that the God that we know as a person is a convenience of expression in relationship to the universe which is created by him, but there is Godhead beyond the definition of any personality. That supreme unknowable reality is the final truth. And we have here in Sri Aurobindo language that connotes the same. Our mind negates God for a beyond, or at least it seems to find God transcending himself, denying himself to the conception. That's that non-being. But here and now he wants to deal with the lower terms of that denial. So bear this in mind, because this carries through two or three paragraphs next, and it's easy to get lost. And the terms of this denial are not, like that other and remoter negation, inconceivable, and therefore naturally mysterious, unknowable to his mind, but appear to be knowable, known, definite, and still mysterious. He knows not what they are, why they exist, how they came into being. He sees their processes as they affect and appear to him. He cannot fathom their essential reality. So denial is now seen from the individual perspective, from the perspective of man, the mental being. So it cannot grasp what is the nature of death, what is the nature of insentience, of inconscience. So Sri Aurobindo continues, perhaps they are unfathomable. Perhaps they also are really unknowable in their essence. Or it may be they have no essential reality, are an illusion, asat, non-being. The superior negation appears to us sometimes as a nihil, a non-existence. This inferior negation may also be, in its essence, a nihil, a non-existence. But, as we have already put away from us this evasion of the difficulty with regard to that higher, so also we discard it for this inferior asat. How he got rid of the problem for that higher nihil, if you will, was to regard it as beyond all polarities of being, beyond all manifestation, as an unknowable which is ever free in its own mysterious being. We use the term being as a convenience of language because it is not being. Being is Satchit Ananda, which in a sense stands out from that unknowability and is the ground of all the universe, of all individuality, of all truth and manifestation. But that unknowable is beyond, unseizable by the mind. It is that that we fall away from. But if we agree that that is what non-being must mean, because being is here somehow, and being had to come out of that, so it must come out of non-being in that sense, that it's not restricted by being, by the positive affirmation of being. Then too, when we look at what the apparent denials of these modes of existence are, we can't get stuck in what the word would mean there. So nihil can't mean what it appears to be in reference to the terms of denial that he's looking at here, with reference to death, disintegration, etc. So, to deny entirely its reality, or to seek an escape from it as a mere disastrous illusion, is to put away from us the problem and to shun our work. For life, these things that seem to deny God to be the opposites of Satchitananda are real, even if they turn out to be temporary. They and their opposites, good, knowledge, joy, pleasure, life, survival, strength, power, increase, are the very material of her workings. So he's about to assert that these conditions of existence are here for a purpose. They are not absent of meaning, and they are not denials of the nature of Satchit-Ananda. It is probable indeed that they, and the they here again are the terms of denial, it is probable indeed that they are the result, or rather the inseparable accompaniments, not of an illusion, but of a wrong relation. Wrong, because it is founded on a false view of what the individual is in the universe, and therefore a false attitude both towards God and nature, towards self and environment. Again, we're back to the problems of harmony. If we have a wrong relation, it's because we don't stand in a large enough context. So we have to be invited out of our smallness of experience, where we measure the diminution into death and incapacity and the like, not from that limitation, but from a wideness in which we are in agreeable harmony with the universe and with that from which the universe comes. To continue with Sri Aurobindo's paragraph here, because that which he has become is out of harmony both with what the world of his habitation is and what he himself should be and is to be, therefore man is subject to these contradictions of the secret truth of things. In that case, they are not the punishment of a fall, but the conditions of a progress. They are the first elements of the work he has to fulfill, the price he has to pay for the crown which he hopes to win, the narrow way by which nature escapes out of matter into consciousness. They are at once her ransom and her stock. So these denials of what we essentially are in terms of sat, existence, chit, consciousness, and ananda, delight, in the throes of the universal development. So we meet death, we meet ignorance, we meet inconscience and the like. Those things we have agreed to go through to push beyond so that we can achieve the great goal of the universe. So Sri Aurobindo continues then in the next paragraph, for out of these false relations and by their aid the true have to be found. By the ignorance we have to cross over death. This is a direct translation from the Isha Upanishad. And remember that the Isha is the basis for this work. You remember that he had written a monograph before ever taking up the Arya as a commentary on the Isha Upanishad, and called it the Life Divine. So here we come back to the 11th verse again, which says literally, by the ignorance crosses beyond death, avidyaya mrityum tirtva, and by the knowledge enjoys immortality, vidyayam mrita nush anush Ashnute, I'm going to get it out yet. So, the ignorance is our very mode of crossing beyond death. In other words, we accept the terms of the manifestation as they're presented to us here, even if they seem to deny the reality of Satchit-Ananda. And by accepting them, attain to a greater knowledge, a fulfillment of the universe, which is a knowledge not only of spiritual essence, but a knowledge then of that essence as it works in the universe. And that is the definition of immortality. because you then own your essential soul, ever free, never born in the sense, certainly never dying, but you have the complete mastery and ownership of the cosmos as well. This is the goal of the spirit involving itself into matter and evolving out of it and upwards, never leaving it, never abandoning it, but pulling into itself higher and higher terms of conscious existence and being, and therefore of power and delight, therefore of truth, therefore of light, conquering darkness. So too, the Veda speaks cryptically of energies that are like women evil in impulse, wandering from the path, doing hurt to their lord, which yet, though themselves false and unhappy, build up in the end this vast truth, the truth that is the bliss. Brahat Satyam, the vast, the true. So, it suggests that even what seems to be a diminished power or shakti knows its route forward to the ultimate fulfillment. Even what seems to be dark and contrary. And we today might object to this idea that, oh, it's evil women that lead us astray. Leads who astray, exactly? They secretly know the route, how to get to ultimate good. It would be then, not when he has excised the evil in nature out of himself by an act of moral surgery, or parted with life by an abhorrent recoil, but when he has turned death into a more perfect life, lifted the small things of the human limitation into the great things of the divine vastness, transformed suffering into beatitude, converted evil into its proper good, translated error and falsehood into their secret truth, that the sacrifice will be accomplished, the journey done, and heaven and earth equalized, join hands in the bliss of the Supreme. Wonderful language, and this really sets the course of future development. We conquer death to create a more perfect life. Achieve the vastness, which is the nature of the divine. Universal extension, exceeding the bounds of the limiting ego. And it's only when we have gone through the whole circuit, when we ourselves carry the sacrificial offering upwards and place it into the being of the divine and return from that as the blessing, as the prasad, in a sense, back to earth, that the circle is fulfilled. The sacrifice has been completed. The sacrifice is never simply a gift given and abandoned. It is really ourselves which are represented in the gift, and we go upwards with it, and then we descend again with the blessings of that divine consciousness back to the earth, not abandoning it, but fulfilling it. As he says here, and heaven and earth equalized, spirit and matter married, joined in hands, cemented in the bliss of the Supreme. And yet, how can such contraries pass into each other? By what alchemy shall lead, pardon me, by what alchemy shall this lead of immortal... I'll start all together again. Yet how can such contraries pass into each other? By what alchemy shall this lead of mortality be turned into that gold of divine being? But if they are not in their essence contraries, if they are manifestations of one reality, identical in substance, then indeed a divine transmutation becomes conceivable. Because all modes of being are essentially one. There are not several universes. All universes are compressible into one great being. All modes of becoming are resolvable into that. So, if indeed contraries don't really exist, but they're complementaries, then always one is transformable into another. Not merely by a mode of logical agility, as when Nagarjuna proves and demonstrates that nirvana and samsara are the same, but in point of fact, in the same way that at the physical level, by analogy, Einstein could demonstrate that E equals mc squared, that matter and energy are essentially the same thing in different modalities of expression. So too, spirit and matter are not antinomies. One does not deny the other. One concretizes one, finitizes one, but conceals that spiritual essence within it. It must have the power of emergence. It cannot have lost its power because it was originally regnant. It was a ruling force. So what is it that wakes it up and moves it out, starts it on its way in the cosmos? So as he says, then indeed, a divine transmutation becomes conceivable. This is also traceable to Kashmir Shaivism. A similar thought is there. And of course, we have been speaking about the Isha Upanishad right along. We have seen that the non-being beyond may well be an inconceivable existence and perhaps an ineffable bliss. At least the nirvana of Buddhism, which formulated one most luminous effort of man to reach and to rest in this highest non-existence, represents itself in the psychology of the liberated yet upon earth as an unspeakable peace and gladness. Its practical effect is the extinction of all suffering through the disappearance of all egoistic idea or sensation. And the nearest we can get to a positive conception of it is that it is some inexpressible beatitude, if the name or any name can be applied to a peace so void of contents, into which even the notion of self-existence seems to be swallowed up and disappear. It is a satchit ananda, to which we dare no longer apply even the supreme terms of sat, of chit, and of ananda. For all terms are annulled and all cognitive experience is overpassed. Again, an attempt of Sri Aurobindo to bring into this Vedantic experience the core of the Buddha's experience in terms explicable to Vedanta in this way. That nirvana must mean this kind of non-being, this unknowability of something behind, beyond, exceeding even the modes of sat, chit, ananda. And then we just finished the ante-penultimate paragraph. Let's go on to the penultimate paragraph. By the way, it was Sri Aurobindo who liked to play with terms like that, so don't blame me. I got it honest. On the other hand, we have hazarded the suggestion that since all is one reality, this inferior negation also, this other contradiction or non-existence of Satchidananda, is none other than Satchidananda itself. It is capable of being conceived by the intellect, perceived in the vision, even received through the sensations as verily that which it seems to deny, and such would it always be to our conscious experience if things were not falsified by some great fundamental error, some possessing and compelling ignorance, maya or avidya. So, above, Satchit Ananda in oneness, below, Satchit Ananda in dualism, in manifestation, in multiplicity. Conceivable, graspable through the senses, and indeed soaking itself into all tissue of the universe so that whatever you experience, whatever you stand upon, wherever you're going, you're only in and going towards Brahman as Satchit Ananda. So we see again his method here, which is to ensure that all contradictions are reconciled in a larger synthesis. He has posited in this paragraph, though, ignorance, maya, and avidya, which we'll have to spend a good deal of time on in coming weeks. In this sense, a solution might be sought, not perhaps a satisfying metaphysical solution for the logical mind, for we are standing on the borderline of the unknowable, the ineffable, and straining our eyes beyond, but a sufficient basis in experience for the practice of the divine life. So, in other words, again, experience is greater than rationality. Experience is what establishes what is true. It is not rationality, it is not philosophy that determines what is real. Epistemology is a tool of philosophy, but experience is the tool of the soul. And a greater knowledge is accessible by the soul through experience than to the philosopher through the modes of logic and epistemology. So at the basis of Sri Aurobindo's life divine is his spiritual experience of Brahman, of Brahmic Nirvana, of Brahman as expressed in the cosmos. And we'll see that he comes back to that and determines that what we examine in the universe and can know as real is all discoverable by the emerging soul power within us. That is what will finally determine what we can become. Not what mind can conceive, but what soul can conceive through its various instruments. The mind is only a middle term of its assay. The greater term, the superconscious, awaits its delivery. To do this, we must dare to go below the clear surfaces of things on which the mind loves to dwell, to tempt the vast and obscure, to penetrate the unfathomable depths of consciousness, and identify ourselves with states of being that are not our own. Human language is a poor help in such a search, but at least we may find in it some symbols and figures, return with some just expressible hints which will help the light of the soul and throw upon the mind some reflection of the ineffable design. So we penetrate the unfathomable depths of consciousness. With what? With our own conscious being. Not what we currently possess, but what we develop. Along the way, human language, philosophy, metaphysics, mythology, etc., may throw to us some light through symbols and figures. And those hints can help elucidate the journey, but they are not the stuff itself. But among these hints, among these symbols and figures, are the very things with which we began this essay. The dawn, which represents the growth of the soul in light. From the dawn to the zenith of noon, this is the quest of the human spirit. And also the idea of the three steps of Vishnu. The first step of the expanding Godhead in manifestation, being to claim the earth. The second step, to claim the heaven, and the heaven represents mind. So matter and mind have been claimed in terms of life. But that third step goes beyond, goes to that world of light, to that world of truth, its own native home, Vishnu's own source. So this divinity which spreads upon the earth and claims increasing powers of manifestation eventuates to its origination in light, where is bliss? Bliss is there. Bliss is the consummation of all our experience. What we experience here in terms of indifference or pleasure or pain all hail from bliss. Just like all the modes of becoming hail from true being. Just like different modes of thought, feeling, sensation come from that pure consciousness. And so next time we take up the ego and the dualities in the seventh chapter. So we have time for a question or two if you care to pose one. Then to our meditation. Jai Ma, Namaste.